Welcome to the Long Thread Podcast about spinning, stitching, and weaving by hand. The podcast is presented by Long Thread Media, publishers of Spinoff, Handwoven, Piecework, and Little Looms magazines. Find us online at longthreadmedia.com. Trinway Silks is where weavers, spinners, knitters, and stitchers find the silk they love. Select from the largest variety of silk spinning fibers, silk yarn, and silk threads and ribbons at trinwaysilks.com. You'll discover a rainbow of colors thoughtfully hand-dyed in Colorado. Love natural? Trinway's array of wild silks provide choices beyond white. If you love silk, you'll love Trinway Silks, where superior quality and customer service are guaranteed. Learning how to weave but need the right shuttle? Hooked on knitting and in search of a lofty yarn? Yarn Bart of Kansas has been your partner in fiber since 1971. Whether you are around the corner from the Yarn Bart of Kansas or around the country, they are truly your local yarn store with an experienced staff to answer all your fiber questions. Visit yarnbarn-ks.com to shop, learn, and explore. I'm your host, Long Thread Media co-founder Anne Merrow. Annie McHale is a weaver of beautiful inkle bands. I spoke to her from her home in New Mexico. Annie, thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's an honor. I've been listening to some of the other podcasts, and it's great company to be in.
Well, thank you. I'm lucky that I get to talk to so many interesting folks. So our listeners can't see what I can see, which is the most beautiful array of bands behind you. And you have a sort of a specific but fascinating niche. Can you tell me about your weaving?
Well, I think the one thing that really sets me apart from a lot of other weavers I know is inkle weaving is the only kind of weaving I do. You come to my house, you will not find any floor looms. I recently sold my rigid heddle loom. I am just an inkle girl and always have been. What's on the wall behind me, these are all wool straps, which are made for historic reenactors. So think mountain men, fur trade era, late 1700s, early 1800s, which is how I met my husband at a mountain man event, but also people who do SCA or, you know, medieval recreation. So everything on the wall here is kind of muted colors, which is not what I'm known for, but these are all wool in muted colors that would be period appropriate. The other thing that I make a lot of is guitar straps, and I've made and sold over 1,000 guitar straps, and people, other inkle weavers know me as someone who likes bright and saturated colors.
1,000 guitar straps. That's incredible.
It's amazing to even to me.
So you're crossing over with this, with these sort of artists in this whole other realm and in a whole different medium and even sense.
Yeah, it is really interesting. I mean, a woven band can be so many things to so many people. And in the world of weaving, it's very simple, but it's also very useful. And that's what attracted me to inkle weaving as a 17-year-old. I could think of items that I could make and use. And so that's what I do. And I was just talking to a friend today. There's a new restaurant and bar that opened up, and they're soliciting fiber arts to hang in there. And I said, well, you know, I make stuff that's supposed to be used, not stuff that's supposed to be on the wall. So, you know, what you see behind me is my inventory hanging out until it gets sold.
Wow.
But in the meantime, it is sort of a little decoration for the dining room.
Well, and in the era that you're speaking of, when mountain men and reenactors, there were no zippers. If there were buttons, they were handmade. So straps, now we think of them as being something that's a little bit specialized, but they used to be absolutely everyday necessities.
Right. And one of the things that's interesting to me, people will say, well, what is that band for? Mm-hmm. And I say, the uses are limited only by your imagination. Mm-hmm. If I put hardware on it, then it might be specific to an item, like a guitar strap has a leather tab on the end. Yet I know people who've purchased those and tied them onto their cameras. So I think before, like you said, now the, you know, straps are very specialized what they're made for, but why not use them for whatever? And I certainly have used them as carrying straps. So, you know, before there were backpacks, you had a book strap, right? You tied your books up and carried them. I've used them to carry home a Christmas tree from the corner lot. My kids helped me one year, and then I've used them to carry a stack of things down to the mailbox. I certainly have them hanging around, so if I need a strap, I just grab one or two.
You mentioned that like a guitar strap has certain findings. Do you think about the finding before you get started weaving, or how do you marry those things together? Because they often have to fit pretty carefully.
Right. So with the guitar straps, I know they need to be 2 inches wide. And when people ask me for 3-inch wide ones, I say, sorry, I don't have that hardware. Or I have customized things somehow, or ask people sometimes to find a leather worker who can match that item specifically to what they want to use it for. But usually I know what the item is that I'm going to make, and if it needs to be a specific size or a specific material, I've got that in mind. So what the finished item is can dictate what the material is that I'm going to use. I won't use wool for a guitar strap or anything that's really going to be worn on the body. In modern times, it's just not comfortable for most people. With the historic reenactors, well, they don't wear it all the time. You know, it's part of their specific regalia or costume or whatever you want to call it. So it's not an everyday thing for them. But a lot of inkle weavers ask me what kind of yarn I should use. And I always tell them, what are you going to make? Or ask them, what are you going to make? That's really going to determine what yarn you use.
But do you have a set of yarns that you use most commonly? Like if I know I'm going to make a guitar strap, I always reach for this. And if I know I'm going to make a reenactment strap, I always reach for this. Or do you ever play with a variety of them?
I do mix a little bit, but with the guitar straps, it's very specific. And I'm using a cotton yarn that is, they call it a sport weight. So it makes a fairly thick strap. And I wouldn't use a thinner yarn, or I wouldn't use a wool, or sometimes a hemp, but it's usually pretty much cotton. And the guitar straps, the people who use them tell me they're the most comfortable strap I've ever had. But it needs to be thick enough to provide the padding over the shoulder. If I'm making key fobs or lanyards, I might use a number 10 crochet cotton. I use a lot of that. So yeah, I've got my different batches of yarn that are in different areas that are for different uses.
And now a word from our sponsors. Brown Sheep Company is a 4-generation family business bringing you high-quality wool and natural fiber yarns. We spin and dye U.S.-grown wool into hundreds of vibrant colors at our mill in western Nebraska. Our mill has something to offer for every craft, from well-known knitting and crochet yarns to wool roving for spinning and felting. We offer U.S.-made needlepoint yarns as well as yarn on cones for weaving. Learn more about our company and products at brownsheep.com. And now back to the show. You know, it just occurred to me that you mentioned that you just sold your rigid heddle loom. And how many looms do you have? And how many projects do you have going at a time?
I have 20-ish looms. Most of those are inkle looms. You know, there's the floor standing inkle loom for the really long things. There's another handmade loom that's really wide for weaving wider sashes. You know, I've got the mini inkle loom for travel, and people kind of tend to give me inkle looms. So I kind of run this home for unwanted inkle looms. And if I can rehome them, I will. But then I've got some tapestry looms. You know, they're all small things.
Mm-hmm. Ever tempted by tablet weaving?
I'm tempted. The patterns are beautiful. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I look at the patterns, I go, well, that's really cool, but it's not my thing. Mm-hmm. I've tried it and I just don't relate to it. Hmm. I love inkle looms for the fact that you can do a continuous warp. No need to prepare the warp over here and put it all on the loom. It's just all one step. Most of the time when I'm warping my loom, my patterns are created spontaneously while I'm warping. In other words, I don't chart the pattern. I'm not working from a chart. You know, I get my colors and I put them on the table. I just warped up for another guitar strap. I didn't use all the colors I had on the table, but it's me making in-moment decisions about the balance of color and the quantity of color within the strap. You know, tend to put dark on the borders and light inside, the lighter colors inside. So and because I'm a balance freak, 99.9% of the straps I weave are symmetrical in pattern. So I warp the first half and then I mirror it back.
It's so interesting that you say that, because your first book was all about different designs, including things that were asymmetrical and all kinds of different color patterns. So was it different for you to think, okay, I'm going to put together a book that tells people how to do this thing, even though I'm a fairly spontaneous weaver?
Well, you know, when I started out, so I started in 1976. For a long time, I did chart patterns. You know, it was the little graph paper and colored pencils or markers even. And then after so many years, it's like, I don't really need to do that anymore. And I like the spontaneity of designing as I go, because if I'm going to put it down on paper, my mind tends to go to the same thing all the time. But I get more creative when I don't have the pattern chart there. But a lot of people don't work that way. And the reason for my first book in celebration of plain weave was because I felt like I was hearing from band weavers far and wide. I belong to all the Inkle Weaving Facebook groups. And so, you know, I'm seeing what people are doing all the time. And it seemed to me there was this general sense that plain weave wasn't all that interesting. That if you wanted to do something cool, you either had to learn some pickup technique or do card weaving. And I disagree with that. I think it's a lot of it is about color. And my husband said this when I was working on the book, and I thought it was brilliant. In plain weave, it's not so much the pattern that's important. It's what the pattern is allows the colors to mix and mingle and blend in different proportions. So what I was thinking was that plain weave can be endlessly interesting and that people just have never really thought about it. They just don't know how to do it. Certainly all the Inkle Weaving books that I had are from the 70s and 80s, where you're lucky if you get some color plates in the middle.
Oh, yeah,
they're not full true. Color books, you know, mm-hmm. They're X's and O's in block charts that show you kind of what pattern you're going to get. But what I wanted people to see is the like juicy colors and the way that you can mix them and the little tricks that I've learned, you know, just one single stripe of a different color can make something pop. It can be a shadow or an accent or all the juiciness of playing with color that people weren't doing in Inkle Weaving. With my guitar straps, I have about 79 warps. That's not a lot of threads with which to introduce color, and your weft isn't playing a role at all. So if you want to make something cool, you need to know how to combine the colors. So in celebration of plain weave, there's 200 pattern charts. And they're interactive because you can use them with an online pattern editor. And I encourage people to play with their own colors, you know, and substitute colors and edit it. But for people who really want a recipe or a pattern, it gives them a place to start. And they can then build confidence maybe to change up those patterns or design their own. And it also has the basic building blocks. You know, how do you get vertical stripes? How do you get horizontal stripes? How do you get checkers or teeth or, you know, chains or all the different elements? So it's giving people an exact recipe to follow if they want. It's telling them how to use that as a jumping off point or how to design their own. And I think that nobody had really done that as in depth as I did it in that book.
I designed one out of there and I used one of the online resources you suggested. And one of the things, because I'm pretty much a rigid heddle weaver, and I tend to think of plain weave as being that sort of grid, maybe not exactly balanced, but defaulting pretty much to balanced plain weave. And so doing something entirely warp faced and those possibilities of things like chains, as you said, or the way things crammed, you know, came together when you weren't seeing the weft, those were elements I'd never really thought of before.
Well, one of the things that's interesting to me, I just signed up to take a weaving class in northern New Mexico in the village of Chimayo, where there's a long history of weaving. And my friend is an eighth generation weaver there. And she's teaching a class in her family's home studio. So I signed up for that. And one of the things that I think is really cool about that is that in the Chimayo tradition, it's all weft-faced. So they're basically weaving tapestries, but in a very traditional Chimayo design, you'll have a banded design at each end. And that banded design is exactly the kind of stuff that I weave warp-faced on an Inca loom. So I've purchased some small woven bags from there, and I take those banded designs, which are woven in weft-faced, and I can match them thread per thread in a warp-faced strap that mm-hmm. then matches the purse. And look, that's fun. That's just fun. Yeah. So in my years, decades of inkle weaving and doing everything warp faced, now I'm going to like make that quarter turn and and dabble in weft faced weaving for a while.
So you mentioned that you started this when you were 17. Where do you think that your color sense comes from? I mean, you've talked about this as being primarily a sort of a color and pattern based process. And so there has to be something in there to keep you engaged for years.
Right? You would think it might, you might think it would get boring after a while, but no, it's endless. The possibilities are endless. I started out just using maybe two or three colors. And as the years went on and there's more yarns available, you know, then I can play with colors a little bit more. And so I started seeing interesting interactions between colors, but having never studied art, never taken a single art course, and not any traditional weaving courses, my color sense, my husband and I argued this point when I was writing the book. He said, well, you have a natural color sense. You can't teach that to people. And I said, of course I can, because there are art classes. They teach this sort of thing. But I learned it from doing thousands of experiments. Mm-hmm. And when I decided I was going to write this book, I thought, well, maybe I should study color before I, you know, put myself out there as an author of a color book. So I bought all the books about from Itten and, you know, all the painters and all the advice about combining color, certainly everything I could find about textiles and color. And I read them all and I went, oh, I have explanations now. There's terms for this. There's words for this. There's explanations why these colors act the way they do together. I knew it from thousands of experiments. And when I read it in the books, it was just so wonderful. And then I kind of condensed it and put it in my book in a way, you know, very condensed, very targeted to inkle weavers. But I've had a lot of people tell me how much that section on color theory helped them mm-hmm. because it was broken down into digestible pieces. So that's really kind of wonderful.
I think people are often exposed to color theory that's sort of abstract. And I know it has the word theory in it, but for each application, it's a little bit different. So not only is it, you're talking about color theory in terms of textiles, but you're talking about it in terms of specific dots and things like that. So thinking about how that applies to bands as opposed to how it applies to, I don't know, tapestry or hand dyeing is a different subject.
Yes. And one of the fun things about listening to the podcast is I get to hear other fiber artists talking about how they use color. Mm-hmm. And it's really kind of interesting to see where our thoughts intersect about these things. Mm-hmm. But Deb Essen, I think, said something that I listened to earlier this week about the point where two colors touch each other and the optical blending happens and it becomes a third color in mm-hmm. your mind's eye. And that was something that I think, you know, with inkle weaving, that's it's very relevant because in your tiny little band, these little spots of color are really, you know, making other things happen. My husband, who looks at everything I weave, always with a positive comment, but he'll be, you know, sitting across the table and he'll say something about that purple in my band. And I'm like, oh no, there's no purple in there. It's blue next to red. Mm-hmm. And right. So he, when he's seeing it from a distance, he's seeing purple. And then I walk over and show it to him. He's like, oh.
The first time I saw a copy of your book, Sarah Lamb had it. And Sarah is a prodigious ankle weaver. She gravitates towards some fairly specific colors. You know, she tends to gravitate toward, say, that, you know, the red, blue, yellow, red, blue, gold primaries with some purple in there. And so it was kind of interesting that, you know, that's not necessarily the first colors I think of when I think of your work, but she just loved that resource. And so it was the first time I checked it out.
Oh, that's sweet. Good to know. Yeah. I think I took a color class from her, like at a Northern California Hand Weavers Conference years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you ever play with things like painted yarns? I think people have come up with all sorts of different hand-painted warps, et cetera. And I know you're probably not working from regular warp chains, but are you ever tempted by any of those hand-painted yarns?
Yes, sometimes. And what I have found is that if I get a variegated yarn and I don't do anything specific with it, it's a lot of spots and speckles, and it's not really that interesting to me. So what I like to do with a variegated yarn is match up the color changes and make a sort of faux ecot thing out of it. And I recently did a blog post with a little video about how I do that. And there can be a little bit of waste. Every time I come around the loom, I might have to cut off a piece to match it up. But I've gotten some really interesting results and things I like that way. Otherwise, I find that it's just kind of a little too random.
I think that's a challenge that a lot of different fiber artists come up with in all kinds of spinners. Certainly, you find a beautiful braid, and if you're not careful, it turns into mud, or knitters, you'll wind up something that pulls that you weren't hoping for. So it's tempting to give up all of your control of color, but then you may not like what you get.
Right.
Yeah. We talked about your first book in celebration of plain weave. Your second book, which was on a pickup technique, is kind of a little different from all of this plain weave talk.
Yeah, it is. And it's not that I don't like pickup. I do a lot of pickup once I feel like I proved my point that plain weave can be cool. You can certainly do other things. And there's a couple pickup techniques that have been fairly popular for a while. Laverne Waddington certainly popularized Andean pebble weave, and Baltic style pickup. Susan Folks has done a lot with that. And there's a lot of those things out there. So a lot of people are doing those. And I've done a lot of Baltic pickup. And I had this one book. It's a old out of print book about Lithuanian sashes. It's called Lithuanian Sashes. Very expensive to purchase, but it has so many color plates and so many photographs and very little text, but visually it's so interesting. And in this one section, I found photographs that I said, as I see these, I'm thinking it's Baltic pickup, but Baltic pickup usually has one background color and one pattern color. And these had three colors that seemed to be trading places. And it took me a while to catch on to what was happening there. And I kept going back and looking at those photos till I realized what they were doing. And when I realized what they were doing, I said, this is brilliant. And all the weavers will want to know about this. So I wrote a tutorial and it had photographs in it. There was no method that I could think of for charting the pattern. So I just wrote the little tutorial. I said, you know, here's how you set up the loom, you know, and there's a chart for that. And here's some photographs of things I've woven. And some people got the tutorial and some people got it and some people didn't. And then years later, the graphic design program that I'm using, free online tool, gave me the ability to chart those patterns. And so I was redoing that tutorial. I said, oh, I'm going to rewrite the tutorial and put maybe 10 patterns in there. So one of my friends who was helping me was Jennifer Williams, who is a extraordinary inkle weaver herself. And, you know, I was bouncing stuff off of her. And she said, you know, Annie, I think it wants to be a book. And so she was right. I was reluctant because writing a book is a lot of work. And yes, after the first one, I said, I might not do that again. But and then because I decided to write the book, then I really dove deeply into that. And I used the online pattern editor to draw up some of the patterns. And then some of them I just sat down at the loom and said, what can I make happen? So I'm really happy with that book and what it did, because it brought this little known variation, this technique that people weren't using, kind of back out into the light of day. And now a lot of people are using it. So it is, and it was a jump. And people keep asking me, but what about the Baltic style pickup? You know, you should have written that book first, because the three color pickup says, well, you need to know how to do Baltic pickup in two colors before you do the three colors. Mm-hmm. So they're like, where's that book? So that one's kind of out there in my future. I've told people, yeah, I need to do that. I'm going to do that. But actually making myself sit down and do it is another thing.
Tried kicking and screaming.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like I have three children. And after I had the first one, I went, oh, my God, I'll never do that again. You know, what a lot of work that was. And I have three. So I figure it could be the same with books. You know, I did the first one, I went, oh, I'll never do that again. But then came the second one.
And you've published these independently.
Yes, because I kind of like to work in my own style. And I've talked to people who've self-published and worked with a publisher. And I think self-publishing just worked for me, so I could do it in whatever chaotic order felt right to me. And I was extremely fortunate. It's a small miracle that a friend of mine said to me when I was working on this book, because I'm just hacking it out in Microsoft Word and trying to stick some pictures in there. She goes, what are you doing? You should be doing it in InDesign. And I'm like, I don't know InDesign, and I can't learn a computer program to write a book, because that's way too much work. So she agreed to do it for me.
Oh, wow.
And she thought of all sorts of things that I never would have thought of. You know, when you look at a good book, you don't think about the formatting. It's mm-hmm. only if something's off that you notice the formatting. Or for me, it was that way. Right. So it's like, you know, what font do you want? Do the pictures go here? Do they go there? How are we going to lay this out? And she made it absolutely beautiful. In my opinion, it just far exceeded anything that I could imagine. And there's color on every page. I think there's maybe three or four pages that don't have an illustration, a pattern, a photo, only three pages that are just text. So it turned out wonderful. And that was so lucky that I had her who had the vision for the formatting that I didn't have.
Yeah. And that's something that's available in print and digitally, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did you learn to inkle weave? Or how did you learn to weave inkle bands, I guess I should say?
Yeah. I was at a craft fair. Mm-hmm. I grew up in Illinois, so I'm at this craft fair with my family, and I see this woman. She's got all her inkle belts and guitar straps and everything out there, and she's got inkle looms. Her husband makes the looms, and they're there selling stuff. And I just went, I want to do that. And so after I left there, I went to the library, you know, before the internet, and it was before we had the internet. I went to the library and I found a book that had plans for building an inkle loom. And my dad helped me build the inkle loom. And then the next time there was a craft fair that she was at, there were like, you know, spring and fall craft fairs at this historic site. And the next time she was there, I showed up with my inkle loom. And looking back, it's kind of silly. But, you know, here I was this kid And I showed up with an Inca loom, and this woman's in the middle of doing her thing at her craft fair. And I said, can you show me how to use this? And she did. And so I took off from there, and I didn't know anything about weavers' guilds, or I had no idea what resources might be available to me other than books from the library. So I was very much a loner when I started out, but mostly self-taught using these books.
But you've gone on to teach others how to do this. I mean, you've taught at a whole variety of locations.
Yes, which is great fun. I just say I love spreading my enthusiasm. Mm-hmm.
That's true. Just looking at the bands behind you, I noticed that there are all kinds of different ends. And, you know, we talked a little bit about findings and matching up a finding, but how do you finish your bands?
If there's some sort of hardware involved, then I'm just cutting through the band and you fold it over twice. And I do all my sewing by hand, which surprises people, but I've never gotten along really well with sewing machines. So hand sewing, it's easier to hide your stitches, and that's great. If it doesn't get hardware on it, like, you know, these straps, just some of them have completely loose ends, some of them are braided or twisted. And I usually tell the customer, you know, the weft is woven back on itself so it won't unravel. The fringes are loose. If you'd like me to braid them or twist them before I send it to you, let me know and I'll do that.
Do people ever wear them out and send for another one?
People end up collecting them.
That's true.
So they might want another one and another one. And certainly I have a number of guitar players who have a lot of guitars. So they will keep coming back for one more and one more. And I did see one of my guitar straps years later and to where it was kind of frayed along the edges. And the reason it was frayed along the edges is because he was always jamming with other people and trading off guitars, and everybody had to adjust the strap to a different length. So the buckle, which is the adjuster, kind of wore the strap out. But some of them live long lives.
Well, and they're intended to be used. I mean, you're not talking about something that'll be just delicately wrapped once around the neck or thrown on the couch. These are useful items.
Right. And often when I'm out in public, you know, I'm somewhere and somebody says, oh, you're a weaver, you know, what do you make? Well, I'm almost always wearing something that I made. You know, my purse has a hand-woven shoulder strap. I've got a hand-woven watch band, you know, it might be shoelaces or a bracelet or something. So often I have something at hand so I could just say, yeah, it's this.
Do you have the time to weave for yourself?
I make time when I need something. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of I'm at the age where gone are the days where I want to wear a fancy belt because my waistline isn't what it used to be.
So I think one of the things I've noticed about weavers is that more weavers than any other fiber artist that I talk to sell their items. But as we're speaking, I'm realizing that you actually engage in more commerce with your woven products than pretty much anybody I've met.
And it all started out that way, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of on a small scale. And then, you know, it was great when I ran into the mountain men, because then I started going to all these events that are specialized. And that's a market where, I mean, they can't go into a store and buy one. They have to find somebody who's in their realm, who's making something that's period appropriate. So that was a lot of fun. I have great memories of camping out. I went to a 10-day mountain man rendezvous in California with my son one year. He was like had his 23rd birthday while we were there. Great memories about doing those kind of events. And we don't do those anymore. For a while, I did guitar shows when I lived in California. At Carlos Santana at a guitar show in Marin County.
Cool. And
guitar makers. And so doing all those shows was great and fun. I don't do shows so much anymore. I do have a craft fair with some friends coming up next week. And I do still sell wholesale. So there's a guitar builders, a family of guitar builders in Albuquerque that have their shop, and you can go in and see how they hand build all their guitars and do these wonderful inlay work. And they sell my straps exclusively because they say she makes her straps like we make our guitars. They're one at a time. Each one is different.
Wow.
And so that's probably the only wholesale customer I have. But then at some point, since I'm selling my own books, books kind of took over as the product I sell more of than the finished product. So it's like having a couple balls in the air, you know, finished product, retail, wholesale, shows, Etsy shops. I've got 3 Etsy shops, and then the books, and then the teaching.
Yeah.
Both locally and here and there and everywhere.
So you've talked about Mountain Men and you've talked about guitar shows. Are there any other sorts of subcultures that you run in with your bands?
No, I think those are 2 niches that I've found that have been really good for me. And the guitar straps was kind of a brainstorm with somebody who was helping me with business planning. And she said, you know, there's these guitar shows. And so at that time, I had this website built. So my straps are marketed under the name Weaver Guitar Straps.
I have come across that, Weaver Guitar Straps.
Yeah.
And you're also known as a spinner weaver, is that right?
Yes.
So you're a spinner as well?
In name only. That is my maiden name.
Really?
Yeah.
And yet you don't spin yarn? I'm sure that somebody has tried to spinnerate you.
I have tried spinning. You know, mm-hmm. I've got a drop spindle or two, and I've had a couple of wheels at different times. But it just never really fascinated me like it does a lot of people. You know, it's sort of for me, it's all about the colors and the patterns in play. I love colors and patterns. I'm playing with that. It's not about the structure of building a piece of yarn, or it's not, the weaving isn't a lot about structure either. It's all about me just playing with color and pattern to my heart's content.
And it also does have that very satisfying rhythm. I think one of the things about spinning, it tends to be very rhythmic, but ankle weaving has the same, like, change the shed, pass beat, change the shed, pass beat, etc.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I find it very calming.
So do I. And the nice thing about ankle weaving as opposed to tablet weaving is that with ankle weaving, if you get into pickup, it's different. But if you're doing plain weave ankle weaving, there really is no question as to where you are. You're either weaving or unweaving.
That's right. That's what I tell people. It's very simple, you know, because whenever I am at a festival, fair, show, whatever, I always have a guest ankle loom with me, and I invite people to sit down and weave with me. And maybe not so surprising, often the kids will go, oh, okay. And adults will go, oh, no, I'll mess it up. Mm-hmm. And I say, well, I wouldn't invite you to do this if I thought you were going to cause a problem.
Right.
It's just a matter of up and down and back and forth. Mm-hmm. That's all there is to it. And kids love it.
But the one challenge with ankle weaving is that, boy, selvages are really important.
They are. And there's tricks. I recently filmed a video, which is, you can find on Taproot Video. Those are the folks who filmed it for me. It's also on my YouTube channel. And it's mostly tips for warping, because there's a lot of different ways of thinking about warping. And my priority is I want to do it quickly. Mm-hmm. So for my guitar straps, I can warp in a half an hour or less. So my way of doing everything is, you know, let's do it the quickest way. But that video also talks about keeping the selvages even. And there's just like 1 or 2 things that if you know them, it is obvious and you got it. And if you don't know them, you're going to have a little lump or a bump or a bubble or a something funky going on at your edge.
Yeah. And once again, you said that you hadn't really taken a lot of formal classes. Are these all techniques that you've sort of developed yourself by trial and error or through books?
It's mostly you do it. You do it and you learn it. Mm-hmm. And for me, you know, it's so far back. How did I learn that? I don't know. Certainly, I did not have anybody show me this is how it goes. And even back in the days when I started, YouTube wasn't a thing. The internet wasn't a thing. So yeah, I think mostly it's me just learning by doing.
But then turning around and teaching that can be difficult. I know that some people, when they learn something through the workings of their own minds, it can be difficult to turn that into something that somebody else will be able to follow.
Right. And teaching has been really eye-opening for me. And I've heard other teachers say the same thing. It doesn't occur to you until you try and teach something that other people don't have the same way of understanding. So what's in my head may not make any logical sense to somebody else. Mm. And so teaching is this very interesting thing of trying to figure out how somebody's perceiving this procedure and what words you can say to them to make it click with them. And it's not the same words with everybody.
And writing a book is even different from that, because when you're teaching, at least somebody can raise their hand and say, no, 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 didn't get it.
So the process of writing a book, it's like you write something over and over and over and over and over again until you think that you've got the wording that just makes it most clear and simple. And fortunately, I've gotten good feedback about how I did that in my books. So big relief.
One of the things you mentioned was that you got the impression that plain weave was, you didn't say wasn't really getting all that much respect, but that wasn't seen as being as interesting as other kinds of weaving. And I'm curious what you have seen the response to band weaving be. So for example, there was someone that I was talking to who was doing plain weave as part of a guild and was told, well, that's not really weaving. And John Mullerkey sometimes, until he got an award for complex weaving, sometimes gets the message that, well, band weaving, there's not enough shaft. It's not really real weaving. And over time, I would imagine that just as trends in weaving change, that being a band weaver, sometimes, maybe I'm just making this up, sometimes it's really cool and sometimes really obscure.
So sometimes I think, yesterday I went to this exhibit in Santa Fe, and this woman, she weaves on jacquard looms, and she had these beautiful pieces that were very complex and sort of tapestry on the front, and at the same time they had an ecot on the backside. And I'm looking at that and I'm like, we're both weavers, but we're in different worlds. Mm-hmm. And within weaving, there's so many things that bring people to it. There's so many different pieces of equipment and theories and ideas and approaches and uses. There's just so many. And band weaving is kind of simple, you know, on the scale of simple to complex. Well, band weaving is super simple. But the thing that I see is there's a whole lot of band weavers. I belong to one of the Inkle Weaving Facebook groups. It's got 14,000 members. I mean, there's a lot of band weavers out there. And it certainly is an entry level for a lot of people. It's just the level I stayed at. But it seems kind of simple and humble and maybe not as respected. However, it does connect me to people across time and across geographic, the whole world is connected by weaving somehow. So it puts me in that mix. And, you know, I get a lot of feedback from people who, it started with the blog. Before the books came, it started with the blog. And people really appreciate the information that I'm giving them that's helped them. And it's so rewarding to me to get that feedback all the time. So I know that it certainly is respected and loved and embraced by a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it's got its place.
That's a good point, that there is band weaving in all kinds of culture, in all kinds of cultures. I was thinking about somebody who used to teach Pennsylvania Dutch band weaving, which was very similar, except that instead of an ankle loom, she was using a rigid heddle. So there's a whole, they don't have as much ability to control a long, there's no continuous warp per se, but people who are able to use an ankle loom for, who are able to use a rigid heddle loom and weave backstrap. And backstrap is certainly something that all kinds of cultures use.
Yeah, I just got back from Guatemala a couple of weeks ago, and it's just, it's wonderful to be in that country, which is full of weavers. And everywhere I went, I could say, oh, I'm a weaver, you know, and they go, oh, you're a weaver, you know, so is that like kind of instant connection? Oh, you get me, you know? I have a collection of bands from all over the world. You know, some are very old, some are very modern. And it's so interesting to me, even I was talking about the technique that has is known as Baltic now, but it hasn't always been known as that. Baltic is sort of it's what it's called now. But when I learned it in the 70s and 80s, all those authors had different names for it. And I like to call it speckled because, you know, that's what the plain weave looks like. It's a speckles of one color against another color background. So as I'm thinking about writing this book about that technique, I'm looking, where else is this technique done? Certainly, it's used heavily in the countries around the Baltic Sea, that whole region. And some of the traditions are very specific about what color your background should be and what material you should use and what patterns you should use. But the way I use it is not from any of those traditions. And I started looking and asking, you know, in the inkle weaving groups on Facebook, it's like, where else is this done? Well, I have examples from Peru and Kyrgyzstan, and those are the two that come to mind. But certainly, it's here, it's there, it's everywhere. I didn't see any in Guatemala, but it's a technique that exists in all different places, and people use it in very different ways, or, you know, even with different materials.
That's true. And in Scandinavia, they use a lot of those different bands. And Kirsten Neumüller, who was one of our previous guests, weaves them with a rigid heddle, but very similar narrow warp-faced bands. And I think if people also don't realize that tapes, when you think about woven tapes, those are also similar, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got to be part of an exhibition at the Museum of International Folk Art in Santa Fe. Mm-hmm. They did an exhibit about Scandinavian dress, and they were looking for somebody who could do a little video of weaving a band with the little rigid heddle on a backstrap setup. And so somebody from one of my guilds, weaving guilds, works at the museum, and they said, oh, you're looking for a band weaver, get Annie. So they called me and I said, I've never used a rigid heddle. And, you know, that's the equipment. They want to videotape me weaving with the little Storstalka rigid heddle. And I said, can I borrow it and practice? Because certainly it's the same structure. It's what I do, but I've never used this piece of equipment and I don't want to look awkward in the video. So I borrowed that. And that was really fun. And it was really fun to, it was a beautiful, beautiful exhibition of Scandinavian clothing, and they had some wonderful sashes and shoe bands and things. And there's a little video of me weaving on their rigid heddle.
Wonderful. So how many projects do you have going on your loom right now, in your looms right now?
Because I have so many inkle looms, I tend to park things and not go back to them. Mm-hmm. So there's probably 8 inkle looms that are dressed right now, and only 2 of them are projects that I'm working on, and they're building up inventory for the upcoming show.
Right.
And then my daughter, my oldest daughter, has recently decided that she is interested in inkle weaving. And so now she's claimed one of the looms. So there's a project for her on one of them.
Good thing you have enough.
Yes.
Do people ever commission you for bands?
Quite often. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people who don't like doing commissions. For me, it's a fun challenge, and I'm pretty successful at it. Every once in a while, I don't get what the customer wants. So that's the big difficulty with doing a commission. It's like the customer has a vision in their head. I need to get that vision in my head. So it's like you almost got to be psychic, because sometimes words don't do it. I get a lot of requests for things that I can't do. But usually, yeah, and I'm usually pretty upfront. It's like, no, I can't do that. I could do something that would have the essence of that, but I can't get that much detail in, and I can't weave your company logo, things like that. You know, they don't know what to expect.
So, unless your company logo is two colors.
And square.
And
not
square.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's been a fun challenge for me, and I've certainly met some really interesting people doing some interesting things. I've done belts for Cirque du Soleil and belts that were, you know, for a movie and things like that.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Wow. So the first time I met you, I believe you were teaching at Convergence, and I know that teaching is kind of taking you all over. What do you teach and where do you go?
I say, have Loom Will travel. If you've got a local guild or a conference or something like that coming up, I am not really good about figuring out when applications need to go in for different conferences. So at this point in my career, I'm relying on people to reach out to me and say, oh, hey, you know, we've got a conference coming up. Would you like to turn in a proposal? Or a lot of weaving guilds. I do a lot of stuff for weaving guilds. And so when people let me know that there's a thing coming up or an opportunity, I love to have those conversations. And I've really had a good time traveling with guilds. It's a lot of fun because they often have a guild member who hosts you in their home. So there's the extra conversations and just kind of getting into the community a little bit. And I'm finding that really fun.
And do you teach based on your books, or what sort of subjects are you teaching from?
A lot of it would be based on the books, but there's a couple techniques that I haven't written about too.
Oh, cool.
So when I teach plain weave, I incorporate things about color and design. I know there's a lot of teachers out there who teach ankle weaving. Usually, it's one thing that they teach out of all these things. But for me, it's only about ankle weaving. So when I teach ankle weaving, I have a little bit different perspective on it, maybe than somebody who does other kinds of things. So I incorporate some of the color and design stuff when I teach basic ankle weaving. And then I teach about three different types of pickup, including the three-color pickup. And as far as I know, at this point, I'm the only one who's teaching the three-color pickup. It just hasn't been out in the mainstream long enough. In this country, anyway, there's a whole group of Dutch ankle weavers, and we've collaborated, and they're now teaching it on their own. But in this country, I think I'm the only one who teaches that, which is kind of fun.
That's so cool. Well, I will look forward to the next time I run into you at a conference.
Yes. Yes. Colorado isn't that far. Certainly, we should cross paths.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Annie, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, nice conversation. Thank you, Ian.
Thanks to our sponsors for supporting the podcast. Thank you for listening to the Long Thread Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate the show and leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Thanks again.